I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
Everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And you're listening to Key to the Case. Welcome back. We have an all new case for you today. But first, we wanted to start out by thanking everyone who has listened to the podcast so far, everyone who has shared the podcast. We are really grateful for your support. And if you're enjoying the podcast, something I've forgot to mention the past few episodes is that you can give us a rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.
Five stars, please.
Yeah. 5 stars would be ideal. That'd be great. We would really appreciate that. And thank you to those of you who already have. Someone asked me this. On Spotify, you can't write a rating, but on Apple Podcasts, you can.
You can also follow us on Instagram. Yep. Key to the Case Podcast.
Yep. And as always, you can reach out to us at keytothecase@gmail.com. That's all I have. You have anything else?
Nope. Let's get into it.
Okay. In 1989, 22-year-old Bridget Phillips was living in Baltimore, Maryland, and was a graduate student at the renowned Johns Hopkins University. Prior to attending Johns Hopkins, she made a big move from her home in Kansas to Gainesville, Florida, where she earned her undergraduate degree in history at the University of Florida. She further immersed herself in her passion for history at Johns Hopkins by pursuing a master's and doctorate degree in Byzantine and medieval history. Bridget regarded Johns Hopkins as the school of her dreams. So she was really at this exciting juncture in her life. And Bridget loved to learn. And it was evident that she was quite intelligent. She was quite smart. She was actually fluent in 6 languages, which is no small feat. You know, especially here in the U.S., where it's not as common, when you're born in the U.S., to be fluent in a number of languages, I think that's really impressive.
Yeah, I don't even think my brain could handle trying to learn that many languages, to be honest.
I know. It kind of seems like something you'd want to start when you're young, but I wasn't clear how young she was when she started learning new languages. It was no surprise that Bridget made honor roll within her first year at Johns Hopkins, and a former history professor of hers, John Baldwin, said she was, quote, unusually motivated for a highly difficult course of study, unquote. Bridget was well known among her fellow classmates, and they described her as being a warm, vivacious, engaging, and talented person. She's also described as being one to breathe life into her academic circle, and she appeared to be someone who was hard not to take notice of. In her free time, which I'm sure was limited, she liked to bake cakes, take in stray animals, and hold brunch for her colleagues on a regular basis. She also participated in sports such as basketball, tennis, and volleyball. She played the piano, and she was characterized as having strong artistic talent. As I was researching this case, it kind of seemed like there wasn't anything Bridget couldn't do. You know what I mean? Like, just so many different hobbies and interests, and her, she's obviously very smart. So I just kind of got that impression that what Bridget wanted to do, she would be able to.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to her character a lot that you mentioned that she's taken in stray animals just to care for. I think that speaks volumes of who she is as a person, you know?
Yes. There's one picture in particular that I'll be sure to share on our Instagram of her with holding this dog. I don't think it was the stray dog, but there's this wonderful picture of her holding a dog, and it's just adorable. You could tell she had a soft spot for animals. Now, there's one friend Bridget had who I want to discuss in particular. She was a fellow history student, but this woman was living in Northern Virginia, and she commuted to Baltimore for school. So Bridget let her stay at her apartment overnight on those nights she spent in Baltimore, and she even had a key to the apartment. And I think that speaks to the level of generosity and kindness that you could expect from Bridget on a regular basis. And this friend made a comment to the Baltimore Sun that really stuck with me. She said, quote, "The newspaper descriptions of Bridget never managed to capture the person I knew. She was warm and generous, in love with her heart. She got to know people from all walks of life. She adopted a stray dog that sadly turned out to have a terminal illness. She spent the little money she had to take him to the vet. She was, as her father once said, perhaps a little too trusting. I worried about her, especially the fact that she had no telephone. I gave her the money to have one installed, but she refused. Despite her gregarious nature, I think that she also liked to be unreachable when she wanted to be," unquote. Hearing those kinds of anecdotes are really helpful in understanding who the person is that we're talking about, right? I know I'll never, as an outsider, I'll never know this person the same way their family did or their loved ones did, but hearing little stories about how they were or things they did is really helpful.
Yeah, I guess I already mentioned how she took in a stray animal, and it speaks volumes to her character. But then you mentioned the part where she took what little money she had being a college student, and she cared for this terminally ill stray dog. A lot of people who would have the money wouldn't even do that. So, I mean, she definitely has a big heart is what I'm trying to convey.
I agree. I think it takes a special person to spend what little money they have left on a terminally ill animal. That you're right. She definitely had a big heart. And her friend was right too, the one who said she was a little bit too trusting at times. Her father had said the same thing and said she was open and friendly with people. He said to the Baltimore Sun that he wasn't sure if that is a fault, but in our society, it can be a problem at times. And I totally hear what he's saying. While I don't think it's a fault to be a naturally trusting person, unfortunately, trusting the wrong person can cause problems, like he's saying. And especially as a parent, you probably don't want your child to be too trusting because you fear what could happen if they were to trust someone with ill intentions. During her time at Johns Hopkins, there were several men who were interested in Bridget, and at least two of them wanted to have a serious relationship. But Bridget ultimately was more focused on school, spending time with her friends, and she was busy with her extracurricular activities as well, so she was altogether pretty preoccupied. There was one individual who, a couple of weeks before Bridget's murder, had been bothering her in the school library she frequented. She told her mom, Linda, about this encounter or multiple encounters where this person who she was not dating or in a relationship with warned her not to see anyone else.
Oh my God. It seems a little fishy.
I appreciate your disgust. Yeah. I thought it was weird too. Like, I don't see why this person who she was not dating with, they're dating or in a relationship with, felt that they had the authority to dictate the choices Bridget made and in her relationships. But she found this person to be repulsive, and her mom recommended that she tell a security guard about this issue so they could help her resolve it. But Bridget told her mom that she couldn't do that And it was about a week later, which would be just a week before her murder, that she told her mom that she had taken care of the situation. As far as we know, she did not explain how she handled the situation. She just said that she had handled it. I mean, we could speculate as to how she handled it, but I don't think there are too many scenarios.
Do you think, and now I'm just kind of speculating before I hear the whole case, do you think she said something just to appease her mom? Or do you think she, I mean, obviously every kid wants to make their parents feel like that they're safe when they're away from home. So I don't know. Do you think there's a possibility that she did that just to make her mom feel comfortable when she's away in Baltimore and her parents are in Kansas?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a possibility. I hadn't really thought about that. I kind of assumed that maybe the way she handled it was just directly telling this person that she doesn't want them in her life or to leave her alone. But granted, we don't know with certainty, but I do think it's possible that maybe if her mom had asked her about it a few times, telling her, hey, I've handled it, was a way to kind of appease her. But again, we don't know. I think we've all been guilty. Sorry, mom or dad, if you're listening to this, I'm sure there have been situations where I've said, oh yeah, I have that handled, don't worry about it, when in fact I don't, but I know I will in the future. So now, she did handle the situation by possibly confronting this person and telling them to leave her alone. That could be motive for murder. Although it shouldn't be, it could be for the wrong person. Now, getting into the timeline in this case, which is really a puzzle on its own, because there are questions surrounding how Bridget actually spent her time before her murder. However, there were a few witnesses and clues that help us piece together some of the events from that day, which was Wednesday, March 22nd, 1989. Bridget was last seen entering the Milton Eisenhower Library at around 6 p.m. when she ran into some friends who she told she was planning to study for a while. The friends left the library and did not see her again after that. That is the last confirmed sighting of Bridget. The next time we can determine what Bridget was doing was around 8:45 to 9 p.m. when she made a call from the library, we believe, to a friend of hers who lived a few blocks away. She intended to drop by and visit that person that evening. The friend said she sounded perfectly normal and he certainly didn't sense there was anything wrong. And she told him she would drop by within the hour, meaning she likely planned to leave the library by 10 p.m. Because no one saw Bridget after 6 p.m. and no one spoke to her after 9 p.m., we enter into this dark spot where we don't know what happened. And I say no one saw or spoke to her, but we know one person did, the killer. But because her friend she was supposed to visit reported that she never arrived, police suspected that she encountered her killer sometime after leaving the library or at the library and returning home, which was at 2843 Calvert Street, located just a little under a mile away from the library.
So you said this was 1989, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm assuming, you know, CCTV, like security cameras weren't super prevalent back then, right?
Right.
So, I mean, there was nothing to pinpoint her exact exit time from the library.
Right. There were zero reports of any surveillance footage in this case or any sort of concrete evidence that could determine where Bridget was at any certain time. Even the phone call that was made, we believe it was from the library, but that's not concrete either. It's just because she said she was at the library when she made the phone call. So there's really not a lot of concrete evidence in this case that tells us how Bridget was spending that night. But like I said, it was assumed that she would walk home from the library, and she was known to do that. So this evening was really thought to be no different. And I think that shows how safe Bridget must have felt in the area she lived in to be walking home at that hour, or walking to her friend's house, which is really where she should have been going, she must have felt pretty safe in her neighborhood. Now, the apartment building she lived in was a smaller building. Looking at Zillow and Google Earth, it appears that this building has not changed much since 1989, at least on the outside. It's situated on the corner of Calvert Street, and according to Zillow, there are 6 individual units in the building and 3 floors. It's the kind of apartment where you have to unlock a main door and then you're inside, not the kind of apartment where you can just walk up to the unit from the outside and there you are. And I should note that Bridget didn't have any roommates, so there wasn't anyone who was expecting her to be home. So we know she spoke with her friend at around 9 p.m., according to him, but like I said, we don't really know what happened after that, except one of Bridget's neighbors reported hearing a cry around midnight, but this tenant assumed this was her own child and thought nothing of it. I would be curious to know which neighbor this was. With the way the building was set up, with 2 units to a floor, if I understand the layout correctly, Bridget likely wouldn't have shared walls with anyone, but there would have been people living above her and below her because she lived on the second floor. I would just like to know if this was the neighbor across the hallway or above her or below her.
Yeah, I mean, man, we don't have kids yet, but I feel like I would recognize my child's cry, even if it's through a wall.
Yeah, I would think so. I thought that was a little bit odd that she thought it was her own child. You know what I kind of wondered, though, was because of the time of night, I wonder if it woke her up and she was just kind of disoriented and maybe she only heard the tail end of the crying or screaming. That was my guess, is she was just kind of disoriented and couldn't really place that sound. But yeah, I thought that was weird too. You would think you'd be able to tell.
Yeah, even then I would probably go check on my kids, see if they're okay, and if they were sound asleep, I would be like, well, where the hell did that cry come from?
Yeah, and maybe she did and just kind of brushed it off. I think we also have to consider that people don't assume the worst probably in a situation like this. I think it'd be different if she heard a bunch of screams or cries and a big commotion. That would be different. But in this case, it sounded pretty isolated. So if this were Bridget crying out, that means we have time between 9 and midnight or around that time where she likely ran into her killer. Fast forward to the next day at 2:45 p.m., the friend of Bridget's who had a key to her apartment decided to swing by Bridget's home to check on her when she didn't show up for a seminar that she was supposed to attend. Now, it was spring break, so the friend thought maybe she had just forgotten about it, even though it would be unlike her. But when she arrived at Bridget's apartment, she found the door was locked, so she unlocked the door, and what she saw would haunt her for the rest of her life. This friend told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "I carry the horror of that moment with me to this day, along with a deep sense of grief. I have watched my own daughters grow up and cannot imagine how Bridget's parents carried on," unquote. Bridget was found just inside her front door, surrounded by blood. Police quickly determined that the person who killed her was filled with rage. She was killed with what appeared to be a heavy hammer with a rounded head or a different metal object. They said it could have even been a small fire extinguisher or even a baseball bat. Bridget was struck only in the head, nowhere else on her body, and Bridget was hit far more times than was actually required to kill her, which is why it's thought to be someone who was full of rage toward her. And the first thing I thought of after learning this was her poor family. I mean, to find out your loved one was murdered is horrible enough, but to find out the way in which she was murdered, I can't fathom that.
Yeah, you follow a lot more true crime than I do, but just the fact that you said she was only struck in her head, that strikes me as obviously like a crime of passion, right? Like someone wanted her hurt and hurt bad.
Right. It feels very personal.
That's what I was getting at. It feels like a personal attack.
And to kill someone in this manner with what was potentially a hammer is just pure evil. There's obviously no acceptable way to kill someone, but using something like a hammer is just hard to conceive. And like you said, to target her head and hit her more times than necessary, it makes no sense. Bridget was the last person anyone thought someone would want to harm. And it just makes you sick thinking about how her life was cut short. And this person, not even a person, this monster got to live on. And again, I go back to being a family member of Bridget's. She was so precious to them. I can't even imagine, you know, trying to understand how someone could even be capable of getting to the level of anger and rage to the point where they felt they wanted to kill her. I don't think you ever can understand that. When Bridget was found, she was fully clothed and there were no indications that a sexual assault or robbery occurred. She actually had cash in her pockets and the jewelry in her home was untouched. Now, you might be wondering about the friend she intended to meet. I was wondering, well, did he just assume she bailed on him or what? And according to a Baltimore Magazine article that I found copied and pasted in the Facebook page for Bridget, this friend went over to her apartment when she hadn't shown up by midnight when the library closed. He rang the buzzer on the outer door, but he didn't receive an answer, so he went home. I pointed out that I got that from the Facebook page because I couldn't find an actual copy of the source, and I looked everywhere. And this was the only place that I read that detail. It could have been left out in other sources because maybe it was deemed not as important in the other sources. But if he came around by midnight, it's possible that he was there when she was murdered because we know the witness in the building heard someone cry out around midnight. Of course, witness accounts and memories are imperfect, so it is possible that he wasn't actually there during the murder.
So was, do you know if he was questioned during the investigation?
I assume he was. I assume this guy is cleared. Did I see that reported on? No, but because the opposite wasn't reported on, that's why I'm assuming that. But it's a fair question because it's interesting because he is placing himself there at basically the time of the murder. And if we want to get really sinister, it could be because he wanted to have a reason to be seen there if a witness did see him there. Again, I think he was cleared. We don't even know this guy's name, so I don't feel too bad wondering about it. But I think it's a fair question to ask. Was he a suspect? Was he a person of interest? As far as I know, the answer is no. Okay. Investigators made several observations from the scene. They determined that the killer did not break into the home. There were no signs of forced entry, and they ruled out the window in the bedroom that was unlocked because there were no footprints on the bed. It sounded like the bed was positioned right by the window, so it would have been cumbersome to get in without leaving any sort of a trace. Because there were no signs of forced entry, investigators deduced that the killer was most likely someone Bridget knew and that she let the person into her home willingly. If you couple this fact with how brutal the attack was, it seemed very personal, right? It makes sense that this was likely not a stranger who killed Bridget. But the question becomes, who was this person and why did Bridget abandon her plans to go to her friend's house? But I do also think about how she was killed right inside the doorway. What if someone followed her home, started a conversation with her right outside her door, and just kind of forced their way in when she was opening her door? I don't think there's any information that rules that out as a possibility, but at the same time, it seems like it's more likely that the murderer was someone she made contact with either at the library or after leaving the library because the estimated time of death is midnight.
Yeah, maybe she left the library. She wanted to drop all of her stuff off at home before going to her friend's house. I don't know if you mentioned if it was on the way or not, but maybe she wanted to go home, drop her stuff off, maybe, I don't know, freshen up and then head to her friend's house. And that's where this happened. Maybe someone was surveilling her and followed her home and was able to possibly, when she opened the first door to get into the building, maybe they somehow slinked inside and she didn't notice that someone had followed her in. I'm not sure the quite sure the situation with the building, but maybe someone was just quick enough to slink in and then followed her up. After she closed the door, they knocked and she opened it up and they were able to get inside with minimal minimal forced entry, and then obviously the rest can be unsaid. But
yeah,
maybe that's why she didn't go straight to her friend's house. Maybe she was dropping her stuff off and took a shower or something, or wanted to take a shower.
Yeah, I like that idea. It would explain why she would be dropping by her home. And I agree. I'm not fully convinced that she willingly let this person in her apartment. Does it seem like it's someone who knew her who did this? Yes. But I can't say I'm 100% convinced that they were right there with her. They walked into her apartment together, just because it seems kind of odd that the person would do it immediately, right when they walk in the door, right? I don't know. Well, maybe that's not strange.
I mean, we're talking about a brutal murder here. I don't think the person is thinking very logically, right?
Yeah, and they had one objective that night, it seems.
Exactly.
So why would you need to get any further in the door, I guess? Now,
were the any of the neighbors questioned? I'm sure they were. Like, did she have any connections with the neighbors and they were any persons of interest?
I didn't see any reports about the neighbors, no. As far as the only thing I heard about her neighbors was the one who heard the cry.
Okay. I mean, yeah, that would eliminate the first door to enter.
Right.
Because they obviously the neighbors would have the key to enter the building, and that would just leave one door to enter. And assuming she knows her neighbors, she might have let them in willingly.
Yeah, and there were only six of them.
Five other neighbors. Yeah.
Yeah, five other neighbors to talk to. It doesn't seem that hard to check them off one by one. During the autopsy, contents of a white meat sandwich were found in Bridget's stomach. So investigators pieced together that's what she had for dinner that evening, considering the estimated time of death and the time when the autopsy would have been completed. But there were no witnesses who saw Bridget at any of the nearby restaurants that evening, and they didn't find any food in Bridget's own refrigerator to point to the idea that she had made the sandwich herself. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard to determine restaurants that were in the area around the library and her home that served this type of sandwich and that would be open around that time of night. Seems like that'd be a fairly small number of restaurants. So if truly no one at those restaurants recalled seeing Bridget, it kind of seems more likely that maybe she had the sandwich at someone's home. But again, it's hard to say. Investigators also determined that Bridget's killer stuck around her apartment for about an hour cleaning up after her, which I found to be quite an eerie detail. They discovered bits of Bridget's bone and blood in the bathroom drain, so it appeared this person cleaned up in the shower. Now, I don't know how they determined Bridget's killer stayed at her apartment for an hour. I think it's likely this was an estimate based on the scene, not necessarily an exact amount of time. I imagine the perpetrator got very messy during the attack since the blood was everywhere. So they probably wanted to clean up so they didn't have blood all over their body when they walked into the apartment. Although it's hard to imagine them being able to clean completely, right? Such as getting the blood completely off of their shirt. And I have to say, it's pretty brazen to stay in that apartment afterward for any amount of time. What if a neighbor heard something and called 911? They must have had some level of confidence that wouldn't happen for some reason, or maybe they were just careless.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of messed up, but maybe they packed a backpack with spare clothes and changed afterward, you know? Like, so they found bone in the bathtub. Do you think that's from washing off the weapon I'm assuming it is, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I pieced together. Again, it's not explicitly stated, but that's how I would assume it got there. Crime scene investigators extracted hairs from underneath Bridget's fingernails, indicating that she fought back when she was attacked. I'm sure they know what color the hair was, but again, that information has not been made public from what I could find. I'm not aware of them finding any additional DNA, and I don't know if in 1989, investigators always had the foresight to collect and save evidence that they couldn't test at that time, but could possibly in the future. I've heard of cases from this time where they did save DNA, so it's definitely being done, but I'm not sure in this case.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that investigators at that time would save DNA with the potential in the future to test it without the technology being there present and at that time. That's pretty good forethought on their part.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't every investigative team or every department, but yeah, I've heard of a lot of cases where that was done. They didn't get any solid fingerprints that they associated with the killer, but there were countless fingerprints in her apartment from all the friends she had and the brunches she would hold. So even if they found a fingerprint and it matched with a suspect who happened to be someone she knew, a defense attorney is always going to argue that their client's fingerprints were in her home because they were her friend. So I think the fingerprints would be more probative if this were someone who was not known to Bridget. But they did find a blurred and bloodied footprint, which was determined to be made by a Head Edge 2 athletic shoe sized somewhere between 8.5 and 9.5. I was not familiar with this shoe, but when you look them up now, just a bunch of ski boots come up. So clearly the killer was not wearing ski boots. And the shoe was described in articles about this case as more of a court shoe that tennis and racquetball players would commonly wear. The shoe clue seems like a pretty decent lead to me, but it didn't seem to go anywhere. The last clue, if you can even call it that, was that the door was locked and Bridget's keys were missing. If you recall, the friend of Bridget's who went to check on her and ultimately found her dead had to unlock the door. So this means that the killer most likely locked the door as they left and kept her keys or disposed of her keys. One of the detectives remarked how unusual it was for a murderer to lock the door of the place they left behind them and that he hadn't seen that before in other cases.
Yeah, what would be the point of that? I mean, it seems like there'd be no point.
I have no idea. And I've thought about this. I don't know if they thought maybe it would take someone longer to find her if the door was locked, but that's kind of dumb. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she lived by herself. Maybe they were assuming no one else had a key and it would take way longer for her neighbors or anyone to get into the apartment. I guess.
Yeah.
That's really the only reasoning I can think of.
That's about all I could think of. Listeners, hey, if you have an idea,
seriously,
let us know, because I found this really odd. What is the point of locking the door? It's just really weird.
Yeah. I mean, also taking an hour to clean up and then locking the door. Like,
I know.
What's going on there logically?
It almost seems like someone who has done this before to me. But if we think it's someone who was in Bridget's life, well, we know most likely none of those people have murdered anyone before.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like she surrounded herself with the right people.
Right. So I'm going to share what one of the detectives assigned to the case shared with the Evening Sun in 1990 as what they believed to be the most plausible scenario of what happened to Bridget. He said, quote, "I think she walked in with the killer in Phillips, still struggling with her books, climbs the stairs to her second floor apartment and unlocks the door. A man enters behind her. She steps forward and casually removes her earrings, placing them on a table. The man raises a blunt object. Suddenly, blood is everywhere. Phillips struggles in vain, clawing at her attacker before slumping to the floor. Her book bag drops beside her on the linoleum, concealing a man's footprint traced in blood. The killer, who lingers in the apartment for almost an hour after the murder, never sees the footprint, unquote.
So, okay, I have another question. How did they determine that she took her earrings off? Like, how did they know that she was even wearing those earrings that evening?
I don't think they could know, but my guess is that because they were on that, what sounds like an entryway table, because they were sitting there, maybe they just assumed she started taking them off when she walked in. But it doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
Yeah, it just kind of seems like a weird detail to add when you don't know for certain if that was the situation. They could have just been sitting there prior to when she left.
Right. And it's hard for me to relate to this because I can't really think of a scenario where I've walked into my home and the first thing I do is take my earrings out. So unless maybe someone said that was a habit of hers, I don't even know how someone would know that. But I mean, I would have to think they'd be pretty uncomfortable earrings for her to be taking them out immediately. But yeah, I thought that detail was kind of odd too. Like, how can you even prove that? But I do think overall, the scenario is plausible. Again, you're left with who would want to end Bridget's life? And we also have to keep in mind who would want to plan to end Bridget's life? Investigators believed this was a premeditated murder, I imagine primarily because of the weapon used and the location being right in her doorway. It seemed like they wanted to do it right away. A hammer or metal object is not a weapon of convenience. It's not something you would normally carry with you. So this being premeditated seems to further support the idea that this person was known to Bridget. I suppose it could be a weapon of convenience if you were in a garage with someone and got into an argument, but I don't believe it was in this one. At the time, it was reported that investigators were honing in on two individuals in particular as suspects, and they were both college-aged men. Their names have not been released, but these are reportedly people who had or desired to have a relationship with Bridget. I wish we had more information on these men, but we can say with certainty that there was not enough evidence to charge either of them for the murder of Bridget. Some people wonder if the person behind the murder was someone who got the wrong idea from Bridget about what the relationship was. Bridget's father said, quote, "There must have been times when she invited somebody over to study and that was all, and he didn't see it that way," unquote. I think that's a very possible scenario.
Yeah, I'm kind of going back to that creepy guy who seemingly thought he had a relationship with Bridget, and obviously it wasn't mutual, and now he's gotten the wrong idea and she cut it off, and now he's just over the top angry about the situation and he just snapped, you know. That's where my head leads immediately is that one guy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He seems like an obvious suspect. If I were an investigator in this case, I'd be interested in him right away. I'd be tracking down who that person was. But the issue I have with that person being responsible is, why would Bridget have let him anywhere near her apartment? She told her mom that this man repulsed her. So unless he did something to change her mind, then I don't know how conceivable it is that she would have spent time with him that evening and invited him over to her home and dropped her plans to see her friend to spend time with this person. So then we go back to the possibility of, did he follow her home? Maybe he even went into her building with her. Like, maybe they didn't have, maybe we go back to what you thought, where she stopped by her apartment to drop her stuff off, maybe change her clothes or something. And then that guy kind of followed her home and maybe started a conversation with her right as they were entering the building. But that is just a complete theory. We don't know. Honestly, we just don't know in this case how the person got into her apartment, but it seems the police think she was spending time with this person willingly that night. I don't know. It's just really coincidental. The timing and location of the incident, where she shut him down, being the library. We know she was at the library that night. I mean, this was someone who was bothering her there. And she handled the situation with this man about a week before her death. Again, that handling of the situation could speak to motive. And he'd be carrying a backpack because he's at the library. He could have the weapon in the backpack.
Right. Weapon, change of clothes, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. I did learn through my research, it's kind of odd, that investigators felt that people in Bridget's circle of friends weren't always being totally forthcoming. The detectives explained that in multiple different interviews, he felt that information was being withheld. I don't know why they would withhold information unless they were suspicious of someone they knew and were scared of that person, or possibly the detective misread the situation and they weren't withholding any details. Detectives were also adamant that someone had to see her between 6 and 9 p.m. or 6 and midnight, and they felt that the key to her murder could lie within those hours. Again, I'm inclined to agree, but I'm sure people saw her after 6 p.m. considering she was at the library, but maybe they just didn't recall seeing her, or the people who saw her didn't know her and therefore didn't recognize her. Which is just so unfortunate because she could have been with the person who would later murder her at that time. It's also a big library, so I figure she could have been tucked away somewhere too. Investigators even reached out to friends Bridget had from all over the world, places like Pakistan and France and Austria. She had traveled pretty extensively, but those individuals didn't lead to further developments in this case. Investigators tried to make headway with the information they had about the shoe that left the footprint at the scene. They reportedly did a check on sales records from 100 shoe distributors in Maryland, but that didn't create any new leads. I think it's great that they did this, because if they came upon a record of sale for this type of shoe for someone they were looking at as a suspect or someone known to Bridget, that could really narrow the investigation. But I also think it's tricky because there's no way of knowing where this person purchased the shoes. This person could have been a student who moved to Baltimore to attend Johns Hopkins, who purchased these shoes in the state they moved from. I would be interested in the tennis team, though. These were described as court shoes, great for tennis and racquetball. That doesn't mean this person had to play these types of sports, but I don't think it would have hurt to interview the players and ask for alibis the night of Bridget's death. I really wish I knew someone who wore these shoes back then to tell me if this is truly a shoe that only an athlete would wear, not just a random non-athlete. Kind of like with running shoes, anybody can wear a pair of Adidas, right? But wouldn't you say there are certain brands that really only runners wear?
Yeah. I mean, you have like Hoka and Brooks. I mean, there's a handful of brands of shoes that really only runners wear. And I have a few of those, but I mean, I would say with a court shoe, no one is really buying a court shoe just to wear, I would think.
But I guess they were casual enough to be wearing them this night. That's what kind of threw me off, right? I agree that you probably wouldn't own these shoes to begin with if you weren't on the court at some point. But I thought it was a little weird that they were wearing them that night, unless they were maybe playing tennis or racquetball earlier in the day.
Yeah, and maybe they had the forethought to wear a weird type of shoe just to throw in the case that maybe a footprint was left behind, they would throw it off.
Yeah. So again, hey, if any of our listeners know about these shoes, would love to hear your take on this specific shoe. One piece of evidence that was kept for some time was the door to Bridget's apartment. That was kept for 5 years in hopes that they could glean a fingerprint from it that could match the killer, but nothing ever came from the door. My heart just goes out to Bridget's family. This was truly a senseless murder. I can't imagine losing someone in this way. Bridget was the opposite of the person who killed her. She was smart, warm, kind, trusting, and had such a big heart, whereas her killer is a monster, a vile human being who took the life of someone who would have gone on to do great things and accomplish a lot. I don't feel hopeless about this case, even though the murder took place 34 years ago. You do hear about cases like this getting solved all the time. But I think what it requires is police focus and effort. And unfortunately, in a city such as Baltimore that does have a high crime rate, I don't know how much energy gets put towards this case, if any, just because of its age and potentially no new leads coming in. This could be a case that just kind of sits until new information comes in, which is really unfortunate. But regardless of the police, if we think about the individual who did this, I wonder how they went on about their life with this violent of a crime. Could they really be a one-time offender? Is this the type of person who would be abusive to their partner if they had one? Are they the type to fly off the handle and show moments of rage, but otherwise be calm and controlled? I feel like there is a strong possibility that the person who killed Bridget has told someone about it after all these years. It could be a matter of time before someone comes forward. I'm just afraid that it's been so long that if her circle of friends knew something and they hadn't shared it, that they'll never share it. So the answer may lie within people who know this killer now. And I think more people talking about this case is a positive here. And more people need to be aware because there could be someone who holds the key and doesn't even know it. This person has gone on free for 34 years. That's 34 years that Bridget lost. Bridget's parents went on to establish a scholarship in her name at the University of Florida. So Bridget's memory gets to live on while helping students, which is quite fitting for the person Bridget was. They also started a fellowship in Byzantine and medieval studies shortly after her death. Her parents really wanted to see students who had that same educational focus as Bridget get the same kind of opportunity she had. Bridget's sister, Michelle, gave birth to a daughter a couple years after Bridget's death, and Michelle named her after her sister, which I thought was really sweet. She is remembered by so many people from all over the world. A church in Austria actually held a memorial service for her, which just shows the kind of impact she made on people and the reach she had. I truly believe this case needs more attention, and I hope one day it reaches the right person or the killer confesses to finally give Bridget's family the closure they absolutely deserve or some sense of closure. Thank you so much for listening today. We're so happy to have all of you joining us for each episode, and we will be back next week with an all new case. Bye.
Bye.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers.
I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Switching between tools for one project gets disjointed, especially on tight deadlines. Grammarly built a game-changing writing surface tailor-made for professionals to help you move ideas forward and sharpen your writing. You can brainstorm ideas, summarize meeting notes in seconds, or strengthen a proposal without context switching. Easy to get started and even easier to finish. Sign up for Grammarly free and get your professional writing from draft to done. Visit Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.